Good morning, church. How are we doing today? Good. Some of you guys are with me. That's okay. Others of you, I might have to wake up a little bit. That's all right. I'd like to welcome everyone this morning to Fellowship Greenville. We are so thankful that you've chosen to come and worship with us today. And it is a great day to be here because this is a day in the life of our church family where we pause from our normal rhythms on Sunday mornings and we put a spotlight on and we highlight the next generation. And just for our own purposes and definition today, when we say the next generation, what we're talking about in here this morning is anyone from birth, fresh out of the womb, okay, one day old, to 18. That's what we mean when we say the next generation. 19 and up, you guys, we are expecting and calling on you guys to help us invest and shape the next generation. Some of our 18-year-olds just started college. They're becoming kind of the influencers now, and I know that's a transition time. But when we say next gen, what we mean is birth through 18. About 9 years ago, I was halfway through my studies in seminary, and a group of friends of mine at school kind of had this thought. We're finishing school pretty soon. And once we finish, the responsibilities in life will escalate. Our free time will diminish. The ability to be spontaneous won't be as available to us. So what if before we graduated, what if we had kind of one last big adventure together, one last hoorah? And seemed like a great idea. So there were five of us. We were all on board. We thought, yeah, whatever, whoever comes up with something, let's just do it. And this idea got thrown out there. What if? Now, hear me out. What if we rode bicycles up the entire East Coast? What if? And I tell you what, like none of us even questioned the logic of this idea. We immediately, yes, that's it. And so this idea began to take root in our hearts. This seed of an idea began to take roots. And we decided that in order for us to do this, we would need to first purchase bicycles. It seems like a logical step. And we got road cycles. Now, I know Greenville is like a cycling hub for a lot of people. So I'm not talking about like, the bikes you ride when you're a kid, like the banana cruisers or anything like that. I'm talking about cycling, like Tour de France type stuff, right? We bought those and they're different. The tires are skinny, so the bike's way more wobbly. Your shoes are, they actually have these cleats on the bottom that clip into the pedal, so you can't just lift your foot off. If that bike falls over, you fall over. I mean, you're locked in. And so we went out and we got these bikes, and this idea started to evolve. But there was a problem. We had a little hiccup. None of us, not a single one of us, had ever ridden a road bike before. And so we didn't know really what to expect. And we also decided that for this journey, we really didn't need to train at all. We should probably just hop in, hop on the saddles and go, right? And so our route, as we planned it out, started in Jacksonville, Florida, and ended in Portland, Maine, just a brisk little step away. Our journey ended up being 1,600 miles, and we pedaled every single one of those miles together. I mean, it was amazing, yeah. Oh, thank you. First service applauded too. I'm going to share more stories of my life as I preach. It just feels good, you know what I mean? We pedaled every single one of those miles together, and we decided that in cycling culture, there's a landmark to hit. Like runners have a marathon. In cycling culture, there's a landmark as well, and it's called a century ride. It's when you ride 100 miles in a single day. And we decided, yeah, we should probably do that. And so we thought the most strategic day to do that was probably day two of our journey. It's logical, you know. No, we thought, yeah, why not? Let's just go for it. And so we did two rides prior to starting. We did a 6-mile ride, which is basically like getting the tires warm, you know what I mean? Like you're just feeling out the bike, you're learning how to shift gears. And then we did an 18-mile ride, which, yeah, notably is more than 6, but compared to what we were doing every day, it was just nothing. On a typical day, we averaged 50 miles at a pace of about 20 miles an hour, and so we really tried to push these things. We did this in the middle of summer as well, and I don't know if you guys have experienced summer in the South. I'm assuming you have, since it's summer and you live in the South. But let me just tell you, it was brutal. Like, I don't know what hell is like, but I imagine it was something like the roads that day. No, we decided we're going to do this century ride together. And I'll be honest, when you cycle, you ride in a line. You ride single file, and you're riding within inches of the person in front of you. And you have to be so careful, because if your tire hits their tire, you could cause them to fall, and that is a domino effect. But you have to stay tight, because you're drafting off of the person in front of you. The more wind resistance you have, the harder it is to pedal. So the tighter your formation, the less resistance, the more energy you have long term. And so we're in this tight formation, and in a cycling team, the lead person has the hardest job, because they're the one out in front. They're the one cutting the wind. They're the one facing the most resistance. They're the one being blown against, and they're really the one setting the pace for the rest of the group with the most difficult job to do. And so we realized that if we're going to do this lead person, we're like learning as we go with it. Like, we had no experience. This lead person is going to need to rotate out every 3 miles or so. So every 3 miles, sure enough, that person would just kind of slide to the left and phase back and tuck in line, and now they're drafting. Give them some relief. And now the next person is up front. And so I will not lie to you. Riding 100 miles in a day is hard. Like, I won't lie. It was challenging. And there were moments, not just in that day, but over the course of this entire trip and summer, where everything is just getting to you. Your legs feel like mush. You just don't have the stamina. For whatever reason, that morning you just woke up and you feel weak. You know, you're trying to balance inches away from someone else, and you're trying not to make them fall. And when you're going downhill, you know, we're hitting 40 or 50 miles an hour with a little helmet on and spandex, by the way. I'm not afraid to admit it. Okay, we had the spandex shorts. Like, you know, there's just so many variables. It's hot. It was triple degree, bouncing off the asphalt. Fresh asphalt, the fresh black asphalt was the worst, because it's sticky. It melts. And so our tires would literally just grip to that, and you'd have to push harder than ever. And there were just days when it's like, I can't be the front man today. I don't have it in me to rotate up. I don't have the strength. I don't have the mental fortitude. I just don't have it. But in that moment, you know that your turn is coming. Every 3 miles, the line shifts. And so you're in this battle, this mental battle and this physical battle, and you feel like you don't have it. And every 3 miles, it shifts, and you get closer and closer and closer to the front. And then finally, you're the second person, and that guy shifts, and now it's your turn. And I'll tell you, for me, there were moments I just felt like I couldn't do it. But here's what inspired me the most. Here's what just gave me the strength in my legs, the wind beneath my wings, so to speak. What inspired me was seeing the guys going in front of me that were experiencing all of the same circumstances that I was, and yet they were faithfully in front of me, doing their job, performing in their role, pedaling hard, keeping the rhythm, keeping the cadence, and setting the pace for the rest of the team. They felt the same way I did, and yet they're up front doing it, and it inspired me in those moments to push harder, to set the pace, to set the rhythm. And I'll tell you, sometimes you would get up there, and you would realize, now that I'm in front, I'm not following anyone. What inspires you then is, I have people relying on me. Like, there's people behind me that need me to set this pace. And this adrenaline sometimes would take over, and 3 miles became 5 miles, or sometimes even more than that, 10 miles. One time on one of our treks, I did a pull for 30 miles straight, just because, I don't know, I just felt it in that moment. The adrenaline kicked in, and the team was struggling that day, and I was just in the zone. And this principle I learned on this cycling team, this principle of life, is that we need people in front of us, modeling to us, paving the way for us what it looks like to cut the wind, to take the resistance of life, to pull people behind them, to inspire those who are coming up behind them. We need people out front. And I couldn't think of a more appropriate principle of life to talk about than that on a Sunday where we highlight the next generation. The next generation is in line. The next generation is looking up front, and they're wondering, man, who am I going to follow? Who's paving the way? Who's cutting the wind? Who's breaking the resistance? Who's taking the brunt of life so that I can follow and learn and be inspired by their example? Because one day I'm going to be up front and there's going to be people behind me that are relying on my leadership and my example and my model. We need people in front of us showing us how to do it. We need people in front of us showing us this is what it looks like to walk with Jesus. This is what it looks like to live a life faithfully to Jesus for the long haul, for the century ride, for the whole journey. We need that. We need that. So I would like to introduce a principle to us this morning. And it may seem like a new thought. When you hear it, it may seem new, but I promise it's not new. In fact, if you dig into the scriptures at all, this is one of the earliest ideas and most consistent ideas throughout the entire Bible. This is a dominant theme throughout the text. It may seem new, I promise it's not. This morning, I want to introduce this idea. Investing in the next generation is a priority to God, and therefore should be a priority for all of God's people. Now, I know you might read that and you think, oh, yeah, of course. Like, I would agree with that. But I've worded this very specifically for a reason. Investing in the next generation is a priority to God. Most of us would say, yes, amen, pastor, yeah. But the second line, this is what might seem new, and therefore should be a priority for all of God's people. The key word there is all of God's people. All of God's people. You see, over time, we've kind of landed in by default in this way of thinking about how we approach the next generation. It basically goes something like this. Either you're a parent or a caregiver, a guardian, or some kind of love giver to a group of children or teenagers. Either you're a parent or you're a professional. You're like clergy, or you work with youth or students, or you work in the system or something like that. Of course, they would invest in the next generation. By default, we've kind of landed in this idea that in order to truly invest in the next generation, you either have to be a parent or a professional. And it's not true. This applies to all of God's people. No matter your vocation, no matter your profession, no matter if you're a parent, a grandparent, or not one at all, or ever have been. Regardless of if you're a professional in the church world or in the world of taking care of children or students or educating them, regardless of if you're a parent or professional, this applies to every single person who claims the name of Jesus. Investing in the next generation is a priority to God and therefore should be a priority for all of God's people. So let's just look at a couple of verses. This is in Psalm 71. I came across these verses this week as I was studying for this sermon. These are amazing verses. Listen to the psalmist. He says, "Oh God, from my youth," this is Psalm 71, verse 17 and 18. "Oh God, from my youth, you have taught me. In my youth, someone invested in me. Someone taught me the ways of you, God. From my youth, you have taught me, and I still proclaim your wondrous deeds." Verse 18. "So even to my old age and gray hairs, oh God, don't forsake me until I proclaim of your might to another generation, your power to all those who come." Listen to the psalmist. Man, you've invested in me, God. You've done things to me in my youth. You've invested in me. God, don't depart from me until I'm able to proclaim all of those to the next generation, to another generation, to talk about all the amazing things you've done. Is that not a fantastic verse for this vision, this idea? God has always been a God for the next generation. In the Old Testament, he was known as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Always this association of three generations down the line. That's who I'm the God of. He's always been for the next generation. I'm just going to hop there real quick. Just follow along with me here. We don't have the slide, but look at Paul as he's writing. This is his last letter that he ever writes, 2 Timothy. He's at the end of his life. He's in prison. This is the end of Paul's journey. Paul is the author of half of our New Testament, arguably the greatest evangelist in all of history, aside from Jesus himself. And Paul is at the end of his days. He's writing to Timothy. Timothy is a young man that Paul has invested in over the years. Chapter 4, verse 10, look at what Paul says as he writes, Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Luke alone is with me in prison. Get Mark and bring him with you. He's useful to me for ministry. Tychius I've sent to Ephesus. When you come, bring my coat. And these are his final instructions, but listen to the wording very carefully. Paul, one of the greatest evangelists in all of history, is about to die. His days are done. Is his ministry dwindling? Is it diminishing? No, it's exploding. It's being expounded because Paul knows my legacy is not what I build, but who I build. Listen to his words. He's mobilizing young men that he's invested in over the years because he knows his time is done. Crescens is gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia, Luke is with me, bring Mark. I've sent Tychius to Ephesus. I've heard people describe this passage almost like a coach calling plays. Fourth quarter, it's a big one. And coaches out there, all right, Crescens, I want you to run a button hook to Galatia, Titus, post route to Dalmatia, Luke, I want you to swing back. We're going to do a sweep, tricky play. Mark, I want you to fall back too. Tychius, I got... You can hear almost Paul's coaching happening in this passage. The end of his life. Is his ministry dwindling? Nope. Why? Because his ministry is not about himself. It's about those he's invested in. That's his legacy. Joshua chapter 4, the Israelites crossed the Jordan River. What does God say to Joshua? Joshua, I want you to grab 12 guys, set up huge mounds of stones. Why? So that when future generations see these stones, your children will ask, why are these stones here? And you will be able to tell them all that I have done and how I've brought you out of Egypt and crossed the waters for you. The idea of investing in the next generation is not a new idea, but I would say it's maybe a lost idea. Because we've made it pretty much about these two camps. You either have to be a parent or a professional in order to do it. And it's just not true. Investing in the next generation is a priority for God and therefore should be a priority for all of God's people. As I was preparing this message, I kind of got to this point in my preparation and I felt like God was saying to me, right here, Matt, at this moment in the message, I want you to apologize to the people. It's kind of a weird thought to have in a sermon prep, right? Like, apologize for what? Did I do something? Will I have said something that's offensive by this point that I don't know? No, Matt, I want you to apologize. And as I listened to the voice of God and as he began to convict my heart, here's what I sensed God saying. That for far too long, the capital C church, the American church, I'm not talking about any church in particular, but the capital C church, for far too long has made discipling the next generation about programs more than people, about practicing programs more than the permanent presence of Jesus. We've made it about events more than a person. It's based more on a plan than a process. And it was accidental. We didn't intentionally just decide, yeah, I want to make sure we're not doing discipleship right. In the 70s, modern day youth ministry was born, children's ministry as well, as families began to break apart and become more and more dysfunctional. The church responded in need, but what happened accidentally and subconsciously is that we slowly started to train our people that, hey, if we're going to reach the next generation, it needs to look like this, and it needs to be this event and this plan and this program and this idea, and that's pretty much going to be executed by professional clergy. You got to be on the staff to do it, or you got to be in the family to do it. You got to be a parent. Unintentionally and accidentally and subconsciously, this church over the past 50, 60 years has taken the responsibility of discipleship away from its own people. And people in turn have basically said, well, I guess that makes sense. If the church is hiring specific youth pastors and children's pastors and family pastors, I guess they're the ones that need to go after all these next generation. I guess my role is simply to attend church and make sure my kids come as well. That is not the vision God has for his people. Not ever has that been the vision. It started off as a good idea, but it became this crippling factor We've forgotten how to mobilize the saints, how to equip the saints to do the work of Jesus. Disciples make disciples. And right now, largely in the American system, most followers of Jesus are relying on the church building and its programs to make disciples. And that is not what Jesus modeled. That is not the heart of God. It's God's people. And I would like to apologize on behalf of the church as a representative of the overall church, because I've been a part of that system, which has relied more on programs than people to do the work of discipleship. And about 7 years ago, God convicted the mess out of my heart because I realized I was trying to replace parents and I was trying to replace people through doing good student ministry. And I am sorry that that's what the American church is known for or has become. But I believe it can get better. I believe there is better if God's people rally around this idea that discipleship rests on my shoulders and investing in the next generation is my responsibility as much as it is a parent's or a professional's. I believe that's what God is calling us to. Investing in the next generation is a priority to God and therefore ought to be a priority to all of God's people. If you've been coming to fellowship at all recently in the past few months, then you know we've been going through 1 and 2 Peter and the book of Daniel, and this theme has arisen, this idea of being an exile. And Peter addresses us right away as exiles in his books, and Daniel and his three friends, teenagers, by the way, are the heroes of the story in the book of Daniel. They're the heroes of their generation because they master how to live in exile and yet remain faithful to God as they are taken to a different kingdom, the kingdom of Babylon. And so the biblical authors looked at the book of Daniel and took this idea of Babylon and made it a metaphorical idea. Basically, Babylon in the Bible becomes this metaphor for any culture or any force whose core values are opposed to God's ways of living. And I would like to suggest to you today that right now the next generation is growing up in what's being known as a digital Babylon. It's not a real city, but it is a real force. It's a digital Babylon. And its core values do not line up with God's values. And the next generation is in a digital Babylon. I've been reading this book right here. It's called Faith for Exiles. It's appropriate since exile has been the dominant theme over the last 4 or 5 months here at Fellowship. This book isn't released yet. Charlie emailed the dude and was like, hey, I heard you're writing this. Can I have a copy? And so he emailed a pre-released copy, which Charlie photocopied for me. I don't know about all that, if that's legal or not, but it happened. It's here, okay? I'm gonna go with yes since he emailed it, and I'm not distributing it, okay? But this is a book called Faith for Exiles, written by David Kinnaman and Mark Matlock. Kinnaman is the owner and president of a group called the Barna Group. And Barna, if you're familiar with them, they do demographic research specifically to gather statistics and data based on these different demographics. And they do tons of different surveys. And over the past 10 years, one of the demographics they've been studying a lot is the next generation. Over the past decade, they've interviewed more than 100,000 teenagers. And their findings are pretty amazing. It's all based on research and data. And so I would just like to extract 2 points from this book that I think could help us as a church body understand how to invest in the next generation in a digital Babylon, 2 realities that the next generation is facing, and then how the body of believers can come alongside of them and help them in digital Babylon. The first principle is this: screens are discipling the next generation. They're going to be influenced by someone. And right now, screens are the primary disciplers of the next generation. On average, the average 15-year-old to 23-year-old spends almost 3,000 hours a year looking at a screen. If you boil that down, that's a little more than 7 hours a day. That's a full-time job, just about. 15 to 23, 3,000 hours a year looking at a screen. That same demographic, 15 to 23, how many hours do they spend a year taking in spiritual content? About 300, not even 300 hours a year. for us in any way to think that we are making disciples of the next generation by getting them into a building and having them listen to a sermon that they may or may not understand once a week, and then maybe not even talking about it later on at home, but certainly they're claiming the right beliefs, so this is making disciples, right? It's not. Their primary disciplers are screens in a digital Babylon. They spend an exponential amount of time on them more than anything else. And so one of the ways that the church has tried to compete with this over the years is to actually make Jesus a similar idea, because everything in digital Babylon is a brand. It's something you follow. It's something you're interested in. Robots predict algorithms and can predict what you're interested in, and so then they recommend those things to you to further suck you into this vortex of digital Babylon. And so we've done that with Jesus. We've made him a brand. He's easier to follow on Instagram than he is in real life right now. And the downside, the side effect of doing this is we've made Jesus tiny. If you're familiar with the term inoculation, it's a medical term which basically means over here is this giant virus, this dangerous virus. So how can we help people build an immunity to this just in case they get it? And so inoculation is when you take tiny strains, tiny doses of that very virus, and you inject a person in tiny, tiny doses so that their own body can develop immunities and antibodies. Their body learns how to fight these small doses of that virus, so that one day if the entire full-fledged version of that virus attacks their body, they've built resistance. They know how to fight it, how to remain immune to it. Our approaches to discipling the next generation over the past 50 years or so have inoculated them to the gospel of Jesus Christ. We have introduced Jesus in such tiny ways, such palatable, understandable, prepackaged ways through programming and little takeaways, that nothing happens more than he gets absorbed into everything else in the digital ethos. There's nothing that stands out about Jesus anymore. We've made our students immune to full-fledged discipleship because we've tried to brand Jesus in a way that is not helpful at all. So what's the cure? How do we combat this in digital Babylon? I would suggest introducing the next generation into a relationship with Jesus that involves deep intimacy. Deep intimacy with Jesus is the cure. Instead of branding Jesus, it needs to be more about the person of Jesus. Instead of a program, it needs to be about the process. Someone needs to walk alongside of the next generation and help them see why Jesus is amazing and life-changing and why he's so much more exciting than a screen in front of them. Someone needs to be pedaling out front, paving the way, cutting the wind, taking on the resistance of life and pulling others behind them to show them this is what it looks like. We need to invite the next generation into experience a deep intimacy with Jesus so that it becomes more about the person of Jesus rather than a program about Jesus. The next thing I would offer about the next generation in digital Babylon is this, that there is clearly an epidemic of loneliness happening within the next generation. It's ironic, because we're more connected to ever than ever. We have more access, open access than ever. We live in the moment of now. If I want information, if I want to talk to someone, it can happen instantaneously. It's ironic that loneliness is at an all-time high. Worry, anxiety, depression, suicide, and loneliness, the statistics are staggering. This generation is the most medicated generation ever, with the highest numbers saying we are lonely, and yet they're the most connected generation ever. For all that the promises that social media offers, it's not very social. It's a paradox. It promises true connections, but it lacks in community. And so our friends and our followers become nothing more than digital names on a screen, and it feels hollow and void. I was having lunch with a student one time. He was describing he was struggling with some stuff in his life, and I just kind of paused them and said, hey, you're lonely, aren't you? You know, guys, we're macho. We don't like to have a finger pressed into our heart. He's like, how'd you know? I said, man, I'm telling you, dude, let me guess what you're doing. You desperately want community. So you're going to social media to try to build this idea that you can somehow have friends and community on social media. But the more followers and the more likes you get, while they may give you a temporary rush of digital dopamine, it feels good and your body reacts to it. It leaves you more hollow than before. So it creates a vicious cycle, doesn't it? Now I've got to share more, do more, post more, like more, follow more to get that same feeling. But then it leaves me feeling even more and more hollow. The next generation is communicating to us. They are screaming, we are lonely and we don't know what to do about it. We don't know why. There is a hollowness in the world of digital Babylon, and yet it's promising true connectivity, and it will never work. In fact, most of the next generation have bought into this idea. I am terrified of missing out. I am terrified of feeling less than. I compare myself to others all the time. Therefore, I need to fake experiences just so I have something to share with the world. It's not uncommon for a student to take 12 selfies and then title it, "Just Woke Up, Rise and Shine." No, you did. You have full makeup on. What are you talking about? Like, this is perfect lighting. The blinds are just so. You didn't just wake up. But we're faking experiences just so that we can share them. This generation might be best summed up with, "I share, therefore I am." We have to get ourselves out there because we too are a brand in digital Babylon, and we got to throw it out. But it's leaving us feeling very, very lonely. So what's the cure? I would offer this. Forge meaningful, multi-generational relationships. It's got to be multi-generational. This next generation needs people out front peddling. This next generation needs to be inspired. They need to see it, tangibly see it, not follow it digitally. They need someone to walk with them. They need someone within arm's length, 3 feet away over long periods of time. That's how transformation takes place. They need multi-generational relationships. It can't just be about the parents and the professionals. It has to be about the people of God catching this vision that we will invest in the next generation because it matters to God and they matter to us. A few years ago, I had a gentleman named Dean. I was preaching in this room. He comes down front after the message. He says, "Man, I just got to be a part of whatever you're doing. I just got to be a part of it." Dean was in his 50s. And admittedly, he told me, "I'm nervous because I don't think the students will think I'm cool or I don't think they'll like me." We plugged Dean in right away into a senior guy's small group. Dean became my co-leader on our international mission trip, our student mission trip. For 2 years, he's been my co-leader on that trip. Do you know what our students call Dean today? They call him Papa. Papa Dean is his name. Papa is a father term. He has become a spiritual father to our students, and he was so worried that his age disqualified him from even being able to reach the next generation. We have to forge meaningful, multi-generational relationships in order to combat the loneliness that the next generation is experiencing. It has to be personal because Jesus made it personal. When God put flesh on and stepped into this world and began his redemptive mission, Jesus Christ could have approached it in any number of ways he chose, and guess how Jesus saw best fit to begin repairing and restoring people to their Creator. Around the age of 30, he gathered up about a handful of teenagers, rough around the edges, knuckleheads. He said, "Guys, why don't you walk with me for about 3 years and we can change this world?" God has always invested in the next generation, always, and has always desired his people to. But we've drifted away from that vision and we've made it primarily about these two camps. You either have to be a parent or a professional. And I want you to know you don't. You are needed. You are wanted. We need people out front. We need people modeling to us. This is what a life devoted to Jesus looks like. Not just sounds like, not a program, not a fun event. This is what life looks like. If you're sitting in the room today and I don't know, God stirred your heart in any way, and you're like, "Dude, I got to be a part of this, man. I got to figure out what this is all about." In Auditorium 1, you can walk right outside of these doors, and there's a Next Steps table right there. Auditorium 2, come on over to this building and find this table. But there's people there that would love to talk to you and just explore some options about what it might look like for you to invest in the next generation on any number of levels. And for you, it might mean serving in the nursery. For you, it might mean being an educator to some of our children's classes. For you, it might mean serving as a small group leader in middle school or high school. For you, it might just mean opening up your home, taking on a handful of people just like Jesus did and walking with them for the next few years. I heard a story recently about an elderly woman who baked a birthday cake for students in a ministry, and they were blown away. Asked her what mix she used. She got offended. She's like, it's from scratch. And they're like, what's from scratch? And so she taught them how to bake, and this class grew. Guys and girls were so desperate to learn from this elderly woman that she eventually grew this thing and taught them how to make a full-fledged Thanksgiving meal, including gravy from scratch. Don't disqualify yourself because of your age or because you don't have the skills or gifts or talents. Jesus invites us to just be present, to share our lives and hearts with the next generation. That's what we need.